From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in dueling online publications this month, starting in the New York Times, with this headline from the writer Kenan Malik, in defense of cultural appropriation. Well, that prompted a response on NPR from Kay Tempest Bradford, who wrote, quote, cultural appropriation is, in fact, indefensible. Bradford writes that we've reached an important moment in which many people are confusing cultural appropriation with cultural exchange. One is harmful, one is not. One can be a form of theft, one cannot. And Bradford writes that it's vital we understand the differences. Now, maybe you have questions about what constitutes cultural appropriation. Cooking food from a different culture? Wearing clothing or traditional garb from a different culture? How much does commercialism and profit factor in? Our guests will help us understand these ideas. I want to welcome them now. Rena Golden Collier is a writer, a poet, and the co-creator of Kumba Consultants. Always nice to see you back here, Rena. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Lauren Jimerson is an artist, an art therapist, and manager of the Iroquois White Corn Project. Lauren, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Real briefly, the White Corn Project is what, Lauren?
The Iroquois White Corn Project is a it's a project that is under the umbrella of the Friends of Ganondagan, who runs a volunteer site that supports programming at Ganondagan State Historic Site in Victor, New York. And what we do at the Iroquois White Corn Project is we're bringing back an ancient heirloom seed, which is the Iroquois White Corn that has been brought back to Ganondagan. And if you look at the history of Ganondagan, there was a lot of white corn that was burned there in efforts to kind of drive out the Seneca people. And I myself am of Seneca heritage.
Okay. And Rena, tell us again what Kumba Consultants is.
Kumba Consultants is an arts and ed agency here in Rochester and serving Monroe County. We work with artists of color to match them and their programs up with schools, after-school programs, anywhere that there's youth or educators of youth or developers of youth. We provide programming, write curriculum, performances, all those kinds of things to make sure that we're pushing the arts into all of those great spaces, but making sure that it's people of color that are having that sort of impact.
All right, very good. I want to start. Let's listen to just a little bit of music from Kenan Malik in the New York Times. Wrote that, what would have happened if Elvis Presley had not been able to essentially swipe the sounds of black musicians? So Jailhouse Rock is just one of Elvis's hits. Listen for a second. We all know the song. The question is, is this not only an example of appropriation, but is there harm? Well, Kenan Malik wrote that, we have to understand sometimes the value of it. Whereas, I want to read what Kay Tempest Bradford wrote for NPR, and then I'll let our guests kind of weigh in. Bradford writes, the truth is that cultural appropriation is indefensible. Those who defend it either don't understand what it is, misrepresent it to muddy the conversation, or ignore its complexity, discarding any nuances and making it easy to dismiss both appropriation and those who object to it. Rena, what side of that argument are you on?
I mean, first off, the question, what would have happened if, what would have happened is a lot, the folks who actually did create that sound, perhaps they would have been of Elvis status. But of course, then we got to deal with racism and all the things that kept them actually out of that world. I think, I tend to agree in some ways with Bradford with the idea of it being indefensible. The idea of it not having going along with, say, an appreciation for, but also giving credit where credit is due. And I think that's the biggest issue with say, Elvis, that still today we credit him with a sound that was not his own. And that many of those who did create that sound and were actually working to develop that sound didn't get any of that due and didn't get any of the capital that he generated. He has a whole empire that was generated off of someone else's sound. Okay. Not cool.
Lauren, your thoughts on that?
I have to agree that I think, a big part of it is like giving credit where credit is due. And, being from a Native American community, we see cultural appropriation all over the place. But what's kind of gaining really big notoriety is in the fashion industry, and also, you know, the music festivals where people are wearing war bonnets, and you know, they think it's okay, but really, you know, we're talking about like the misunderstanding of it, you know, that it's actually a symbol of honor, you know, that is earned, and you don't just have the right to wear it whenever you feel like it. Like, it's very sacred to a group of people. And, you know, even within the Native American community, like, I don't deem myself wearing a war bonnet as okay. You know, I have high respect for that as a symbol. So, you know, there's issues within the different Native communities, too.
The writer Maisha Z. Johnson would take what Lauren just said, and I think probably add one point based on her definitions, which I'm going to read in a second. It's one thing to take the war bonnet and say, well, I want to wear that. Even if you're not part of the culture, you don't understand the meaning of it. It's another to sell it and profit from it when you're not part of that culture. And here's what Johnson writes to offer a kind of starting point about how to explain what cultural appropriation is. Johnson, and this is what Bradford wrote in her NPR piece, offers an excellent starting point by describing appropriation not only as the act of an individual, but an individual working within a power dynamic in which members of a dominant culture take elements from a culture of people who have been systematically oppressed by that dominant group. That's why appropriation and exchange are two different things, Johnson says. There's no power imbalance involved in a cultural exchange. And when artists appropriate, they can profit from what they take while the oppressed group gets nothing. That makes sense to you?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, I have a friend who owns a graphic design company. And so when he is asked to speak places, he spoke at RIT back in November. His name is Jared Yazzie, and he owns OXDX. And, you know, he speaks about cultural appropriation in the fashion industry. And, you know, and talks about exactly that, how, you know, these fashion designers are profiting off of something, you know, that in a very disrespectful manner, you know, something that is theirs that's taken from a whole nother country or culture, not country.
and to back to Rena's point about Elvis, this wasn't just a case of a white musician saying, hey, I like the sound, I think I can make it work for me. Mm-hmm. This was a case of a society where we obviously knew racism was prevalent in the personal side, on structural side, and so you had a lot of talented black artists struggling to be heard and to make money, and then you had a white artist take that sound and profit from it.
Absolutely. I mean, you can, as an artist myself, I definitely am okay with the idea of collaboration and cultural exchange. It's something that we do. We exchange not just culture, but all, you know, across forms. You know, there must be appreciation, first off. There must be respect, and there must be an effort to honor what was. You know, especially if you are going to adapt it and make it your own in some way, it's quite okay to, you know, to borrow, to lend, you know, and again be inspired by. But it's another thing when you completely capitalize on that, and you know, and those who actually created it are left out of that. So I go someplace and say, teach me what you do, and then I go and make money off of it. And you know, and at no point, not only do I fail to give due, but do as in come here, do this thing with me. You know, there's a case in education that is, I'm also a teacher, I'm an educator, and there's a school that was created off of, there was a black woman who had this style in her classroom of using call and response, using you know, just rhymes and just things that were, you know, just a really rhythmic format to teaching, and she would come up with little things to in her classroom with her students, and this was all just really just based on African American culture and what works for us, just the oral tradition. Call and response. And, you know, there was a young white male teacher that, you know, was interning or studying in her classroom, or a co-teacher, maybe a teaching assistant, and eventually got his own classroom and kept adapting this style. And at some point created a whole charter school movement out of it. And so why that school is not named after this woman, and why, more importantly, this woman isn't a, you know, multimillionaire from, you know, founding a charter school, you know, that's the issue. You know, that's the issue that I definitely take issue and offense.
I already have a couple of emails from listeners who are sort of weighing in with what they've, either their thoughts on the word appropriation or sort of questions on, is this a case, is it not? It's a good opportunity for us to have that discussion. So first of all, if you want to call the program as we talk about cultural appropriation and cultural exchange, the differences, examples, or questions you have on examples, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'll try to hit three real quick right off the top of the bat. Phil writes to the program and says, Evan, this is all way too sensitive. I'm tired of being told I can't even make burritos at home. I didn't know anybody who told Phil he can't make burritos at home.
Phil, you can make your burritos at home.
This is not an example of appropriation.
Yeah, but I don't think, Phil, you should probably go out and start a food truck chain for burrito making if that's not your culture. And, you know, I mean, and if you do, at least, you know, why don't you partner up with someone who, you know, whose culture you're appropriating to make money. Why don't you do that?
Okay, but cooking at home, Phil, make what you want.
Man. Yeah.
In fact, make those burritos, learn other cultures,
Absolutely.
Maybe bring that in. But that's very different, again, than profit and oppression.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Let's see here. Jill wants to know, where is there a place where there is a power equilibrium? So there's more exchange and less appropriation, or not appropriation and instead exchange.
I'm a community partner of a class at Nazareth called Trauma and Resiliency. And I've been a partner with them for maybe 3 years now. And, you know, the focus of this class is like the historical trauma. And because, you know, in the community we have, you know, the Haudenosaunee community present, you know, me and other people at Gnonegan have partnered with this professor at Nazareth, and she kind of created this class, but she brings in, you know, people from my community, my family members and my friends, and we kind of, you know, we share our experiences so that, you know, these students can understand, like, what the actual authentic, I guess, for lack of a better term, or the real experience of being Native American is, and coming from, you know, because they're learning about trauma-informed care. And so I think, you know, the topic of historical trauma has only become part of this sort of landscape only recently. And it's becoming a large part of this conversation, you know, in Native America. So I think that, you know, the professor who teaches it is Dr. Marie Watkins, and she's always, you know, consulting with the community partners, you know, is this appropriate? Is this okay? Can we do this, like, constantly? And I appreciate that she does that. And we did have a conversation about cultural authenticity. And I think that that term needs to be a part of this conversation. You know, it's whereas a culture is represented authentically, you know, the language and the customs. And I think, you know, there has to be an understanding with respect of a culture in that sense. So, you know, that's an example that I can think of where there's like an equilibrium, mm-hmm. where, you know, I think also we need to, you know, realize that the other, you know, can serve as an ally, but, you know, there's a way to do it. And I think that's where the mix-up is, you know, where people just don't understand how it can be done appropriately, I guess.
Okay. And listeners, I would just say exactly what Bradford, our guests, Maisha Z. Johnson, they all agree that this is not necessarily a case where everyone's going to agree on every case, that this is appropriation, this isn't. And there are times where the line blurs a little bit. Now, there are times where it's not that blurry at all. But Again, you may disagree. Some of what you're hearing this hour, that's okay. But if you want to share some of your thoughts or questions, you can do that. 844-295-TALK. Toll free. 844-295-8255. And I'll just share an example because I was going to ask Lauren again for her thoughts on appropriation, especially in professionals and college athletics. Mm-hmm. Here's an example. I'm from Cleveland. I grew up a baseball fan. Of course, it's the Cleveland Indians. Mm-hmm. Chief Wahoo as a mascot. Took my 5-year-old son to his first Indians game, and I'm not even comfortable with the name of the team, let alone the mascot.
Yes.
And I thought, in some sense, buying tickets is supporting that appropriation. But in another sense, here's what we did. He wanted to get a little bat, but it had the Chief Wahoo logo on it.
Yes.
And I said, we're not getting it. There's nothing in my house with that logo. I'm sorry. But, and we talked about why. He's 5, but we talked about why.
Yeah.
To the best that I thought a 5-year-old could sort of handle it. And then I went and had a conversation with some of the people who are selling it and letting them know, you're not getting another dime on any merchandise, and I'm not going to come back to the stadium until we at the very least get the mascot out, and then we need to talk about the name. Mm-hmm. And of course, somebody in line says to me, oh, come on, it's just tradition, we're honoring them. And I said, we are adults, it's 2017, we could be the Cleveland anything we want. Why does it have to be? So the pushback you hear is people saying, well, I think it honors them, doesn't it? And you look at all the money being made in the use of this. Even if every single mascot was somehow perfectly dressed and sort of correctly representing a culture, which it's not.
Yeah.
But then you think about the money. So anyway, how do you feel about professional sports and college athletics, Lauren?
I have a lot of feelings about it. And, you know, I appreciate you speaking up on, you know, on the behalf of, I guess, you know, our communities. And, and right there is like a very touchy subject, you know, because we are talking about like, you know, an oppressed people, and, you know, the whole mascot thing is about us kind of reclaiming our identities, you know, and if, I mean, you really have to look at the history of how, you know, Native American people have been treated by the American government and kind of recreating what our identities were. And, you know, it became novelty to be Native American. And it's like, you know, you're taking a whole group of people and replacing their identity with what you think they should be. And, you know, that's why we're seeing like high instances of substance abuse and, you know, and in some communities, suicide, you know, because it's all an issue of displaced identity. And I know people think like, you know, something as simple as like a mascot, you know, like how does that, you know, factor in? But it's actually, you know, I mean, just imagine when you're trying to find something to identify with and that's it. And it's really a false sense of identity. And, you know, from my personal experience, I grew up thinking, you know, I was supposed to be like this fierce Indian, and to find out that like my people where I actually come from, my ancestors were like very peaceful. So it's very misleading. And I think it's hard to really understand the complexity of it unless, you know, you've really experienced life that way.
I would just say also from a parent perspective, I was curious recently when my friend was with a group of kids, and I just kind of wanted to ask about, you know, what do you understand about, you know, what are Indians, you know, because I'm thinking Cleveland Indians, what do they really know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For the people who think, well, what's the harm? Number one, the harm is profit for a dominant culture and sort of subversion of a culture that has been mistreated. And then talk to kids today. So again, this is a group of kids, and we all have to do better, me included, on what we're teaching kids. But what I heard from a group of kids was Indians don't exist anymore.
Correct.
Incorrect. You hear that, but that's totally not correct.
Yeah.
And then basically something associated with war. Well, why is that? Everything's about war cries, et cetera, as opposed to, no, we've got friends who are Native Americans. Of course they exist today. You know, they're part of the fabric of... So then you have that conversation. But you see what the appropriation does just for the general understanding of who we are living amongst here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to do with who tells the story, too, because these are this is coming from stories that we've seen, you know, and it's happened, you know, with my culture as well, with stories that we've seen played out again and again on the big screen and the small screen and everywhere you go, someone else telling the story. So who gets to actually tell the story is, you know, he who is in power and, you know, and if you're not of the culture of the stories that you're telling or the stories that you're incorporating into your own story, then there's a, you know, a good chance that you're there's some oppression that can be happening, and also, you know, you're perpetuating some of the damage that's already been done, and there has to be some undoing. The dominant culture has to say, okay, before I can even exchange respectfully, there has to be some undoing of the damage that has already been done.
Yeah. And I think, you know, conversations like this, like, people have to be vulnerable. And in today's society, vulnerability is, like, looked down upon.
Weakness, right?
Yeah. And I see vulnerability as being strong, you know, and that's how you can, you know, build bridges and create understanding, is being vulnerable.
Well, let me get to our phone calls, but we've got some folks on the line. We're going to start with Bob in Mendon. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I've been thinking about your Elvis analogy, and I think we have to be a little bit careful here, because maybe it wasn't his original work. However, he made the sound popular among mass audiences, which then opened the arena up for a lot of black artists, you know, Bo Diddley and Little Richard, Fats Domino. They all came out as a result of that. Now people were listening to, quote unquote, that type of music. And without Elvis being able to start that, even by their own admission, these artists said they would have never been heard or become famous or popular. So I think there's needs to be some credit given to the fact that, yeah, maybe it wasn't the right thing to do necessarily, but it offered an ability for a lot of people to then showcase their work.
Did it, though? I'm asking honestly, Bob. I don't mean to be sort of snarky here. Did it? I mean, did it really open the door for black artists who might have otherwise not? And why was the door closed to begin with?
Well, unfortunately, in the time that Elvis came out, we had, you know, even larger racial problems than we have today. And Rolling Stone did a very long article about the impact of Elvis. And they cite, even John Lennon said, before Elvis, it was nothing. And it really, truly opened, it was a brand new sound. Now, brand new sound to mass audiences, not a brand new sound to the people who were creating this type of music. But no one was listening to that type of music because people could not get the airtime if you were African-American. So Elvis was, I think we should at least credit him for allowing this sound to be accepted.
Right, Bob, thank you for the phone call. I mean, I don't hear someone defending racism, and I hear someone acknowledging that it was structural racism mm-hmm. that was preventing the sound mm-hmm. from breaking through to begin with. But then, do we give Elvis credit?
Can you imagine what would have happened if Elvis and his producers and those who wanted to see that sound actually go far actually said, we love this sound so much that we want to give the same opportunity that we're giving to Elvis, to a black artist who actually originated it. And what that could have done to really, you know, counter some of the, you know, the racial issues with breaking into those industries. And would Elvis have been willing to give up his crown is another question. Would he have been willing to take a stand? He didn't. He didn't give credit. I get the indirect benefits. I kind of get some of those, but the direct ones are much more powerful. If someone had taken advantage of those direct ties to say, okay, this is not my sound. Here, I'm going to bring this one out on stage, you know, with me, for example. I guess I tend to go back to what has to be done in terms of the undoing before we can start giving credit, you know, to what happened after the fact, just kind of a natural migration. Because what becomes problematic is then when we retell the story, it's even further disempowering to the group that it comes from. Further disempowering in the sense that when we start saying there was nothing before Elvis, there was nothing before this. It was a brand new, like, even the language that we use to go back and tell the story it still erases, right? And then we say, and the side note caveat is that, well, of course we know that some people were listening, but we're not using language that levels, you know, that playing field, and that's where, you know, it's appropriation and not an exchange.
Now, here's Miriam on Twitter says, so glad you're covering covering cultural appropriation. I'm not always certain what is insulting versus an homage. For example, dressing like a geisha for Halloween, appropriation or an homage to their beauty? that one made the room just took the air out of the room.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, it's hard to get into, like, I tend to start looking at the person and, you know, and Halloween is a tough one for me because I tend to, you know, want to stay away from dressing as someone else's culture because, I mean, unless I am in some way taking an effort outside of that day, October 31st, to actually honor and respect and pay tribute and learn about that culture, I can't see how I'm doing it any justice.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I guess, like, you know, dressing like a geisha is right up there with dressing like an Indian, and I don't support either one of those, you know, because again, when someone dresses like an Indian, it's the stereotypical image of the Indian, and, you know, and I'm sure, you know, like, I mean, if you know anything about, you know, geishas, they were actually these artists and, you know, they trained for a long time to be able to do the things that they did and, you know, to learn how to do the makeup. And when you're like putting on the Halloween costume, like mm-hmm. you're taking the honor out of that artistry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one way I've seen it done very well in terms of a cultural exchange amongst artists actually was Gunandegam. I took a group of kids there this year, mm-hmm. and the opening video has Garth Fagan Dance. Dancers from Garth Fagan Dance Company are a part of the story. There's a I can't remember exactly what the story is.
It's the creation story,
yeah. Right? And what I loved is that I know that there was a process of the learning, the exchange of learning the dances, learning where the dances come from, the story went along with it. It wasn't extracted out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we were talking about that balance earlier. That video is actually probably a perfect example of that.
Absolutely.
Balance, you know, because like you said, we brought in Garth Fagan dancers and they worked with Iroquois social dancers and learned the dances and then took our social dances and created their own choreography from it to kind of match. And then there were, you know,
they danced together too. Video didn't strip them completely from it and say, okay, now we're going to have these famous dancers dance out your cultural story.
Yeah.
It was, everyone was incorporated in together. And I think that's something that's inherent in artistic collaborations when done well. I'm not saying that people don't, you know, miss it sometimes in the arts as well, but when it's done well, that's what the goal is. You don't just start with, I want to do this thing, you know, come teach me how to do this thing. Okay, now I'm going to go and take it and go do this thing.
Yeah, and we're late for a break. We've got a lot of comments that have come in from listeners, and it's becoming clear to me, and I understand that some people, I think, are struggling with the idea that, are you saying that one person from one culture can never do something from another culture? And that's not at all the message.
No.
But we'll get to more of your specific comments and questions coming up. Megan Mack, help me remember. Another thing I'm remembering here, they mentioned Garth Fagan and Gunandegam. I'm thinking of Yo-Yo Ma. We talked about it on the program with music from around the world, different cultures around the world, Iranian, just music from a lot of different cultures. And with the intention of great musicians learning very different styles and cultures and blending it together as best you can in an actual sort of overt effort at some kind of unity or bridge building. That's very different than saying, I'm going to learn from, that's called the Silk Road Ensemble. Thank you, Megan May. Mm-hmm. That's different than saying, hey, here's a group that's historically been oppressed and they've got this beautiful thing, but, you know, the wider culture ignores it because of racism or structural mm-hmm. oppression. Mm-hmm. I'll take it, though, and I'll make a little money myself. That's very different.
And I'll let them stay on that level.
And I won't credit them.
Too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So very different. So check out the Silk Road Ensemble as just sort of another example of that. Marion Penyan, get your email coming up. We'll take more phone calls. Dr. Walter Cooper called. Is that right, Megan? Dr. Walter Cooper called with a comment as well, which is timely because it's Jazz Festival, and he had a comment about jazz. So let's get our only break of the hour and come right back with our guest, Serena Golden Collier, who is a writer, a poet, and the co-creator of Kumba Consultants, and Lauren Jimerson, who is an artist, an art therapist, and manager of the Iroquois White Corn Project. Coming up in our second hour, you want to reduce your carbon footprint? Maybe you go with solar, What about geothermal? We went to a house in Fairport where, well, the family put in just about everything you can think of. Solar, geothermal. They're trying to kind of get to net zero when it comes to the actual output. And we'll talk about how to do that, what it costs, what the sort of feedback and the return is. All of that explored and your questions answered next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You might have seen a number of articles in the New York Times, on NPR recently, about what cultural appropriation is or is not. Cultural appropriation in pop music, cultural appropriation just about anywhere, and how to define it, how to understand it, how to understand the difference between appropriation and exchange. Because it's true, not everything is appropriation, but it's also true, not everything is exchange. And our guests are talking about that. Dr. Walter Cooper called and wanted to make this comment, and we'll let our guest respond. He said, one of the most cruel forms of appropriation is jazz. When Louis Armstrong and other legendary black artists were playing, critics said it was not an art form. It became prominent when white musicians started playing it. That's from Dr. Walter Cooper. Mm-hmm. Rena, do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that we definitely have seen that. We see it also play out in some forms in hip hop as well. I that's one of those things where we've had to, I think we've done a really good job, culturally speaking. We've gone back to sort of fetch it. We call that Sankofa. That's a concept, an African concept of, you know, you have to go back and take the things and make sure that you're actually defining them and even rewriting some of the narratives around them so that it is powerful. I think we've jazz is one that I would say we've done a better job with than most, you know, after it's been appropriated and saying, wait, hold on, this is still ours and this is what it is, you know.
Okay. Lauren, you want to weigh in on that at all there?
I don't know too much about jazz myself, but I like how you're talking about in Native American community, we talk about reclaiming the reclamation of our culture. And what was the word you used?
Sankofa.
That's really cool. I really like that.
All right. Let me also grab let's see here. There's so many comments on where do I want to go next here. Just a lot of people, I think, struggling on the difference here. And some, you know, more Elvis comments. I guess what I want to do is I want to turn to what the Huffington Post did. They put out a list at the end of 2015, 10 times black culture was appropriated. And they got some pushback, mostly by white people, on examples. So let me just give you some of the examples they have here. The Canadian version of Elle magazine called the dashiki the newest it item. Elle Canada caught some heat when they called the dashiki the newest it item of note. It showed several celebrities, both white and of color, wearing the garment. And when Elle called the West African garb the new kaftan, they completely disregarded its origin. It wasn't new. People have worn them for ages. And there was never any explanation on what the style or background was. So Elle Canada celebrating the newest it item, the dashiki, is an example. They say, you know,
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, all of a sudden, dashikis were everywhere. And the interesting thing about it is they showed up, you know, just in the community in a big way, too, because they started trending. And that's when I got really nervous. You know, the idea that it actually got repackaged and sold back to us, you know, something that is of our culture. That was like, whoa, kids were wearing dashikis all over the place. Last summer at, you know, every youth festival, everywhere you went, they were just, and I'm like, oh, it's great to see us embracing our cultural heritage, except that it's made in China right now, and that's a little problematic, you know. We've seen this in retail just over and over and over and over again. Just, you know, them taking what's hot right now or something that, you know, might look new. It might be new. I just saw this and I like this because I've got this eye for fashion, and not recognizing that it has existed long before this. And, you know, are there, now this is one that I'm not as troubled by from what, as Lauren was talking about, there's not a lot of, there's no ritual in place in particular for, say, a dashiki. Dashiki can be worn, you know, it's just worn, you know, it's not necessarily associated with any particular ritual. There are some garments, some garbs that are, and there is definitely something in the fabrics, the actual prints and patterns that go along with different tribes and different families even. Often there's, you know, there's families that have a particular a fabric that is a part of their culture. But again, the dashiki is one that is worn on the continent as fashion. And so the only thing that's problematic is, again, the language that we use around it. It's new. It's, you know, it's hot. It's trending. And, you know, and then who actually is getting paid off of it. If they were getting these dashikis from Africa, you know, from Ghana, from, you know, from Guinea, if that was happening and they all said, you know, made in Ghana, then I'd be like, OK, let's go, you know, but. I saw a lot of made in China.
Yeah. And Lauren, when it comes to Native American culture, I mean, there's probably plenty of examples of style that ends up being appropriated.
Yeah. And when Rena was talking about it, I was just remembering like a few years ago, I was at a restaurant and I heard this girl say she was a white girl saying that she wanted a pair of moccasins for Christmas. And, you know, I had this reaction, like, it just kind of made me angry because, like, you know, I learned how to make my own moccasins when I was a kid, and that's what we do. And, you know, you learn how to make it. And that year, like, you know, you were talking about the dashiki being everywhere. Everybody was wearing moccasins. And I was like, I just couldn't believe it when, you know, when I knew people were really proud to learn how to do that themselves, and it takes a lot of work, and now they're being mass produced, you know, probably made in China. It just instilled this, I don't know, this anger in me.
All right, well, let me go back to kind of a starting point. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about what cultural appropriation is, what it isn't, how to distinguish, and then the harm that can be done here. Jesse and Henrietta writes and says, Evan, I'm still struggling with the concept of cultural appropriation. It seems the message is that one race or culture may not partake of another culture's look, dress, language, etc. Doesn't this further the idea of the other? If we are supposed to embrace each other as equal citizens of one world, how can we then say that dialect or dress or music is only okay for you if you look like me? Doesn't that further drive us down the road of separation as races and cultures? And finally, what about intent? It seems that intent is rarely brought into the conversation. The message I'm getting is that the panel has decided what is okay, period, and it doesn't matter if one's intent is to embrace another culture. Jesse, first of all, thanks for the email. I'm just going to say I disagree with that, especially that last part. I mean, I think intent is at least a significant part because so much of profit, if it's about profit, the intention is we're going to make money, and we might make it on the backs of people who have been oppressed or ignored or treated in a way that is different than a dominant culture. Mm-hmm. So the intention is different than even when it's an honest mistake. It can still be appropriation if the intent is good, but that usually helps if your intention is not necessarily just to profit off somebody. Mm-hmm. So I'm not getting that, Jesse, but I do hear you when you say, you know, are we saying you can't dress like another culture? Are we saying you can't enjoy and play their music? So Rena, let's back it up and let's answer his first two paragraphs.
It definitely is very personal. It's like I said about even just like the Halloween costume when we talked about that. It becomes very personal when we start talking about intent and intention. Again, my intention as an artist when I'm collaborating across cultures is going to be first an appreciation, definitely a respect, and I want to honor, you know, the culture that I'm bringing in. And that, you know, I can't really judge whether you're doing that. I can't see inside your heart and say, okay, you're doing that, you're doing it well. But so that's when it becomes very personal, that you have to say to yourself, what exactly am I doing here? Do I just like the colors? It just looks, you know, the colors look pretty, and I have no interest in that culture, and especially when we look at, if we are talking about an oppressed culture, an oppressed, you know, group of people, am I doing something that is, you know, in some way honoring their struggle, and in some way trying to participate in the undoing of that oppression, or am I just, you know, I'm gonna just roll with it and get what I can get out of it and allow that to continue. There is something that we can do as consumers that in my opinion, you know, you're using your dollars, and you did this when you talked about the merch and whatnot. To say, okay, this is what I'm not gonna do with with my money? And then here's what I am going to do with my money. If there is an opportunity for me to have some sort of exchange, is there something that I'm giving back if there's funds that are generated from this? And again, am I actually working with the people that and asking questions and saying, mm-hmm. hey, you know, I want to have, you know, Native American, you know, culture represented in this piece or in this, you know, the design decor of this, you know, this building. How do I do that in a way that is respectful? And not that, you know, you're going to be the authority, Lauren, but you know, I'm making the effort, you know, and saying, okay, and that's where intent, I can say, yeah, I think intent is a big part of it. And so you have to ask yourself, what is my intentions? And am I actually acting on those intentions? If it's to be good, you know, positive, in the same way that I'm acting on the intention to make money or just look fashionable right now.
Lauren? Mm-hmm.
I think a big piece, it would have to be like education or like, you know, seeking knowledge about, something, you know, I know like when I learn something, I share it with my kids. And so if I see something that I think isn't right, I make sure that my kids know and understand it. You know, certainly I don't think one person is like, you know, an expert on all things cultural appropriation, you know, and I think that there's probably some unintentional ignorance, you know, out there.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and if your intent is to honor somebody by, you know, wearing a mascot on your shirt, then you're, you know, I see that as you're showing your ignorance because you're not really looking at, you know, the people, like what's underneath, you know, you're not actively searching out that knowledge or information about it. So, you know, I think there needs to be like movement, you know what I mean, as to understanding, like really understanding something, opening your mind, opening your eyes, opening your ears, you know, just being open-minded and listening.
I realize now we could have done a couple of hours because I'm going to lose the hour before I get all the subjects in I want. So I'm going to kind of move quickly. HuffPo also had a number of comments about hairstyle. And they pointed to Kylie Jenner's dreadlocks, where she was on the Teen Vogue cover and she was heralded as edgy, raw, and beautiful for wearing dreadlocks. However, when Zendaya wore the same hairstyle at the Oscars in February, the fashion police host Juliana Rancic said she looked like she smells like patchouli oil or weed. Now, although Zendaya responded with the utmost class and got an apology, it's just another example, according to HuffPo, and hard to argue here, of white women being praised for the same styles black women are derided for.
Absolutely.
Rena, I know we've talked about that on this program before. But that's an example that HuffPo says, a good example of appropriation. They also pointed to Allure magazine. They instructed white women on how to achieve an afro. And said even white women can have their own afro. So they're pointing to that as well. So.
Yeah, I mean, and this, it reminds me more so, you know, we've had this conversation about hair and style. And, you know, and again, this is when things get a little personal. When we start talking about personal style, are you, you know, yes, of course, you can rock any, you know, style, personal style you want to, you know, but just also be prepared, you know, to be, examined in such a way that says, are you appropriating or are you, you know, in some way honoring. So what, you know, what else are you doing here? It brings up to me the issue of language, actually. I experienced this as an educator, and I just spent about a little over a year and a half in one building. I've been an itinerant teacher for 20 years where I'm, you know, I push into classrooms and schools and create programs in collaboration, but actually being in one space for a period of time, I saw a lot of things that became really consistent and, you know, informed my pedagogy in a different way. One of them is the idea of when we're trying to connect with kids, connect with youth, you know, using youth culture and in this case, Black or Latino culture, if we're talking about schools in our city, in the inner city, they have predominantly, there are our white teachers, you know, teaching these students. I sometimes hear attempts to use language to connect with the kids. So, but the language tends to sound to me like, you know, mimicking or, you know, kind of caricatures of what Black language sounds like, you know, get your behind over here type stuff. And that's an actual quote I heard a white teacher use talking to a Black student once. And it, you know, it stopped me in my tracks. It made me super uncomfortable. And, you know, my, you know, head kind of went to the side as I started to, you know, the researcher in me wants to know exactly what you're trying to do with that. You know, what is this connection you're trying to make? And you know, I had a conversation with that teacher. But more importantly, I've actually been criticized or in some case almost criminalized for bringing cultural references, cultural knowledge to the table when we're thinking about how we educate Black and brown students, you know, where a room full of white educators, they don't want to hear that. They don't want to go deep with it. They want to use the language, some of them I'm generalizing, use the language or the dialect or the, you know, or hip hop or something and sound like I'm, you know, I'm down. But then when we go deeper, because this is where my work is really based in, you know, in culturally relevant and culturally responsive pedagogy, when we start to go deeper and examine this, suddenly everybody shuts down. Mm-hmm. Suddenly we don't want to think that deep. Oh, it's not really about that, or I didn't really want to, you know, go there. And, you know, and that's where it becomes problematic. So in that case, then I would say, then no, don't use that accent when you're talking to Black students. Absolutely not. If you don't want to also have a conversation about how language is used to oppress, how when Paulo Freire says language is never neutral. So let's talk about whether we allow home language to be, you know, to be respected and honored when we're looking at Black and brown students, and then build from there instead of telling them that they're wrong or they're speaking bad English, you know, when they speak. So that's an example for me.
I just have so many listener calls and emails and I just can't get through them all. So I will close by hanging on food. There's a lot of food questions. I'm going to read a tweet and then an email, and we'll let our guest jump in. David says, I fear for the melting pot with this discussion. How would we have Cajun food if cultures did not learn from the other? And Mary, let's see here, Mary and Penyan. Wow, lots and lots of emails. We could have done all this all day here. Mary says the following. Let's turn this around for a moment. Is there a problem when Black, Hispanic, etc., appropriate aspects of European-derived culture? By the logic presented, no Black person should serve spaghetti on a food truck without hiring an Italian. So Mary and David are concerned about, you know, food crossing cultures, learning from the others, and then how do we... So let's work backwards here. Rena, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
You know, the word assimilation, you know, kind of pops up for me is that, you know, sometimes it wasn't our choice. You know, I don't know that we were necessarily appropriating as much as, you know, assimilating and trying to survive. You know, I mean, if I had my druthers, I would prefer to be on the continent right now, but I didn't get that choice.
Now, what about Mary saying, by the logic of this conversation, which I disagree with, but I understand what she's saying, a Black person should never serve spaghetti in a food truck unless they hire an Italian.
Is it good? How's it taste?
Yeah. And also, it's unlikely, Mary. Again, you got to look at oppression here.
Yeah.
And who's been exploited. Exploitation and oppression seems to be a big part of this. And my guess is most European cultures, I don't want to overgeneralize, but most European cultures are generally not in that category. But
I mean, you know, if he becomes Mr. Spaghetti and it's a, you know, a chain, you know, going all over the world and becomes a millionaire, then I don't know, maybe you got to fight on your hands here. But in this case, like, you know, the power dynamic is off.
Power dynamic, yeah. Lauren?
Actually, I was just kind of reminded of this article by Sally Roche Wagner about how the American cuisine actually has a lot of indigenous, you know, foods in it when you think about like succotash and stuff like that. And, you know, and even the comment about, you know, serving spaghetti, Black people serving spaghetti. If you actually look at history, tomatoes are indigenous to America. So, I mean, is Italian appropriating the foods indigenous to America? Mm. Noodles didn't come from Italy either. Think about where the roots of this stuff comes from.
Food is definitely a murkier one.
And I
understand the intent of the question, but what I'm left with this hour is this. I wish we lived in a world that we didn't have oppression, structural racism, unequal power dynamics. That is not the world that we have lived in. We can strive to create one where those are lessened and eliminated. But until then, when you think about culture, when it comes to food, when it comes to fashion, when it comes to music and all kinds of things, think about oppression. Think about who's profiting, who benefits, and why. That's what I'm kind of left with. Think about intention and what we all can do to at least support, especially people who have been oppressed, and maybe learn from them. That doesn't mean don't cook interesting foods. Hey, Phil, make that burrito, man. Rena, Lauren, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate both of your contributions this hour. Let's take our only break between hours, and more Connections is next.